Approaching on a 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. On at 15 seconds, guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here.
Welcome to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Today I'm going to do a little bit something weird and wonderful. I spent 46 years since I had my first UFO sighting and basically spent a lot of time looking at paranormal phenomena. And I figured for this podcast I would actually just list all the weird things that I have experienced. And it's not that many. It goes back, my first sighting, to May of 1975, but before then, I can't recall ever having thought about UFOs. I definitely do not recall any sort of paranormal event, ghosts banging doors, anything like that. And so, I want to list the things that I had happen starting in 1975, and some of them are pretty weird. This is the kind of stuff that's going to be banned from the UAP task force reports that come out, and undoubtedly will be kept out of any upcoming congressional briefings, along with stories of nuclear shutdowns, crash stories, and a long history of UFOs around the world. This is the kind of stuff they really don't want. They want you to talk about the threat and the technology. And I just saw a poll tonight that was at 87%. The Pew survey showed 80% of people in the United States did not believe that UFOs are a threat. So, but that's going to be all the discussion in Washington when it comes to congressional briefings and Pentagon reports. It's going to be this whole threat. They're in our airspace, all that kind of nonsense. Anyway. So, I was walking around, and that's where I got these. Some of these ideas started to come back in my head. Now, some of these are recorded in YouTube videos, and some of them are in books. Some of this stuff is in a book called. It's a book on portals and manifestations. Some of it is there was a YouTube video that I asked Sinead Wellahan to do, dealing with the synchronicity thing that I'll be talking about in a minute. But I was walking around, and so here's the version. I had a lot of sightings in 75, 76. But I had five that were pretty close, pretty dramatic. The first one was May of 1975. I've told this story many, many times. I had no interest in UFOs. The only reason I went out there was because people were reporting seeing this thing out there all the time. I considered it to be like buying the lottery ticket. There's a chance I could win, but I wouldn't win. I did actually know someone who won $8 million in the lottery. So I know people can win lotteries, $8 million, but I can buy all the tickets I want. I'm not going to win. And the same thing happened here. I figured everybody else, other people will see it. We're not going to see anything. So we went out, and I told the story. We drove into town, around the town, and we were driving around for an hour, and we didn't see anything in this town called Carmi, Manitoba. My friend Larry, who was driving, said, okay, let's go back into Carmen one more time. If we don't see anything, let's go home. And that's when I said, fantastic. Been a total waste of time. We drove into town. We turned to go drive into the town. We made the turn. We were about a mile out. Turned the car around, headed west back into town on Highway 3. The thing appeared from the left to the right. Nobody asked, is that what it was? Everybody's looking around trying to figure out what they were looking at. Nobody said, is that a star? Is that a planet? Or is that what they're looking at? Everybody just went, there it is. Everybody instantly knew. It was so weird. It was so bizarre. Down very low, a couple hundred feet off the ground, maybe not even that. Bobbing sort of up and down, red plasma, almost like it was alive. Very bright, flying in front of the car, across the road, heading from south to north. I was floored. I was jumping out of the car. I was running across this parking lot to watch this thing as it slowly flew off into the north. Two nights later, I had my second sighting, close sighting. And this is one that even just the last couple of months, I've suddenly realized a new piece of the story. And they occur to you over time that little bits of understanding as to what happened start to come back to you. So the second night, I drag all my friends out. They're there for about an hour. Then they say, we're going home. We're tired. They take off. But 15 minutes later, this thing appears, and this time it's flashing. It's like a flash cube. But it's almost like if you were to see a fly inside a bottle, flying around inside a bottle, jumping all over the place, back and forth and up and down. And it flashed the first time, and these little kids said, is that it? And I said, I guess so. I was standing there looking. We're looking into the west. And as it came closer, I guess the flashes got closer together. Next thing I remember, there was a guy taking photographs. He was unloading this camera with a Nikon camera. It had a motor drive on it, one of the first motor drives, and he was shooting as fast as he could, photograph after photograph, as this thing was coming at us. Flew directly at us. One girl couldn't see it because it was bouncing around the sky to start with. She was crying. People were yelling, swearing, jumping up and down. And as it came right in close, it was the same object we'd seen the first night. And again, very, very low to the ground. Red plasma, which is why they call it Charlie Red Star. And it made the left-hand turn and again headed off into the north. Now, it was only in the last couple of months, or maybe even the last month, I suddenly realized, yeah, it was kind of weird. Because we always used to wonder in 75, what was this thing doing in Carmen, Manitoba? There was no sort of reason it should be there. There was no industry. There was no reason why it should be in this small town all the time. And I'm going to do a series on nuclear weapons. And I did an interview with Bob Deamer, who ran the airport in Carmen. We did a long interview with him last summer, and we're going to put that interview up. And he's the first to tell me it had to do with the nuclear weapons. And I'd even forgotten about it, went back 30 years later, and then he got even more insistent that it was a nuclear weapons, and I started to put these pieces together as to what had actually happened. But it had made this left-hand turn, headed off into the north, and I was thinking, like, what's it doing? It wasn't doing anything, because we couldn't figure out why it was in this small town. So as it flew away, I was watching it, and I only realized in the last little while, why did it come at me? If it was in the west, it was on the western horizon, why did it just not fly straight off into the northeast? Why, or into the north? Why did it come at me in very close? It was maybe, I'm not sure, half a mile away when it made its turn and headed off into the north. Why did it come at me and then make the turn? Why didn't it just fly from the west into the north? And the more I look at the 75 events, the more I realize that most of what happened there wasn't random. It was actually intended to be, because I was the only person that was really affected by it. There was, by one poll at the high school, 59% of the kids said in the last 2 years they'd seen something. So there was a lot of people saw stuff, but I was affected much more dramatically than everybody else in terms of how it affected me when I saw this thing and the fact that it would come in very close. So the third event, the third of the five events was, this would be 1976. I got a friend by the name of Jim. He's got his telephoto lenses and his camera. He's going to film this thing. But lots of people come out with me and said, oh, we can film this thing. Don't worry, we'll get it on film. And of course, we didn't get that much film because it was the days of 35 millimeter film. It's not like, there was no digital cameras. There was none of that kind of stuff. It was old time photography. And we were standing at Sperling, which is about 11 miles east of Carmen, on the edge of town, and we're watching for the big ones to come flying by so you can film them. Nothing happened. It got dark, and then I said to him, "What are these orange lights flying? What are these orange lights around us? There's like farm lights from each farm has a farm light in the main yard, and I think they're 18 feet high." And yet they were as orange as oranges. And because we had nothing else to do, there was nothing flying around the sky, we went down this highway, which is called 205, and there are mile roads that run every mile north to south, east, and west. So there was a mile road. We took the second mile road, and that would head us directly towards the U.S. border. And when we made the turn onto that mile road, we saw that this orange light was sitting in the middle of the road. And to make a long story short, this went on for maybe an hour, where we would drive very slowly and this thing would be there. And it looked like it was hard to tell because at night it's completely dark. You can't tell whether it's a big object very far away or whether it's a small object in very close. But it appeared to be a quarter mile down the road, maybe the size of 3 feet across or something like that. That's what appeared. So we drive down there, and it never got any farther away or any closer to us. We get to the first mile road. There was a dump yard there where they were burning garbage, and we thought, "Wow, it's not that. It's still on the road." So they had the light beside us with the fire going, and we still had this object in front of us. And it went mile road after mile road after mile road. And later on, we went back and counted, and it was the 8th mile road. We got the 8th mile road, and then halfway down between the 8th and 9th mile road, going east and west, was a bridge, which was like a drainage bridge where they would drain the water off the fields or floods and stuff like that to move the water. And as we came towards this bridge, then we could see exactly how big it was and where it was because it was on the bridge. So it had some perspective. And even though it was very, very bright, it wasn't really lighting up the bridge. It was just the weirdest type of light. You'll hear experiencers describe this light on board a craft, that it's 500-watt light bulbs, but they can't see where the light's coming from. Very, very bright, intense light. And that the light, as it goes from one room in the UFO to the other room, the second room doesn't have any lights on, but the light from the room doesn't go into the other room. It's not cast into the room. It's like the light stops at the door, but the door is open. So it was that kind of light. We called it a dead light, that it was very, very bright, but it wasn't lighting up anything. It was almost touching the edge of the bridge, and yet it wasn't lighting up the bridge. So we drove with the car up onto the bridge, and the thing was gone. Looked under the bridge, figured it's got to be under the bridge. Didn't see anything. And I figured at that time, there was an object that was recovered by the National Enquirer. They were offering $1 million reward for proof of UFOs, and they had received an object that was called the Bates Ball, which I believe was found in Florida, and it was a small steel ball that had no seams in it. And they had x-rays of the thing, and there was something on the inside of it, but they weren't able to cut the object apart. Now, whether the National Enquirer still has that, I'm not sure, but I never heard any resolution as to what this thing was. But I figured it's got to be one of these Bates balls that's under the bridge, and so we drove now over the bridge, down the other side, heading towards the U.S., heading south towards the U.S., looked around and looked ahead, and the object was gone. It was no longer in the middle of the road. Looked around, the thing was back on the bridge, and now it's behind us. Turned the car around, we go back onto the bridge again, the thing's gone. Look under the bridge, and the water was very, very high. There was snow. It was April, so it was just melting. It was very, very high water under the bridge. You couldn't really see. We had flashlights. We're trying to look under the bridge. You couldn't see anything. Then took the car and we drove north back where we came from, heading away from the U.S. border. And it got about a quarter mile away, and I looked back and said, "Jim, it's back at the bridge. Come on, let's walk this time." And had an 8mm movie camera. We had binoculars. We had the flashlight. And so we walked, and I knew that it had disappeared twice when we came to the bridge. So I said, "It's going to disappear. I want to get something on film." So I would take 7 steps, then shoot 3 seconds of film, take 7 steps, shoot 3 seconds of film. And this went on and on and on. Next thing I knew, I was like, hard to describe, it's 45 years ago, 50, 75 feet. It was close enough that I was going to jump on it. I said to Jim, Jim, hold the camera. I'm gonna jump on it. And I figured that I was right at the bottom of the bridge, and I would have to run up the incline to the bridge, and it was sitting in the middle of this wooden bridge, which is not that big a bridge. And I figured I could hit it before it took off. I could swipe at it, and I wanted to touch it before it would take off, because I knew it was going to take off. And so then just before I handed the camera to Jim, he said, hang on, I think there's one sitting on top of the car. And I said, what? So I said, give me the binoculars. I turned around, and I looked, and one of these orange things was on top of the car, but it was only half. It was like a half moon. So we're looking into the north. And it's this orange half moon thing, very, very bright on top of the car, and this sort of orange smoke hanging down the sides of the car. And I said, oh, this one's sitting on the car. So I started to run towards the car, and it moved in front of the front hood. But before that, I turned around, and I said, oh, yeah. And I turned around, sure enough, the bridge was gone. So it had run this decoy thing, and I figured, well, we're committed now. So we kept running, and then it moved onto the front hood, and you could see it through the front and the back window because the car was facing away from us. And it looked like the car was on fire inside. It was just totally lit up. And then it moved down in front of the car, and it went into the water. There was water on the fields. It wasn't very deep, maybe a couple of inches deep. But it looked like we had on this road in the middle of the ocean. It was just this road going through this water. You could see these orange things hanging above the water, and they were reflecting off the water, so it looked like two oranges, one on top of another. But it was definitely the reflection of the top one onto the water. And these things were surrounding us all over the place. Nights later, we would go and we would chase this thing. It only stayed orange for a couple days, then it turned white. But it was always there, may still be there. We called them monitors, now they're called orbs. I talked to the Canadian government guy that did the metallurgy for Wilbur Smith on UFO material. He said, oh, they're monitors. We had them back in the 1950s. They called them monitors. They would monitor what was going on. And that was the impression we got, that instead of flying the big crafts around, they would drop these little things, and these little things would be all over the place monitoring what was going on. They could tell exactly what was going on the ground. So anyway, that was the bridge thing. And the next couple of nights, Jim and his friend came, and we would race down these mile roads because they were completely straight, and have the lights off, and we're going 50, 60 miles an hour down these roads chasing these orange lights around. Never did get around one. We took photographs, and people would say, let's surround it. We tried everything. We couldn't really do much with them except flashlights at them and get them to flash back, and photograph infrared and color and all this kind of stuff, and people bring their cameras out and try to, film this stuff on these abandoned roads. It's kind of weird. And so we had the bridge. That was the only time I really got close, except for a second time, which would be that summer of 76. I would take out different people, and I was taking out a bunch of kids, and we had gone. We'd seen it was on the road, on the second mile road, and we had moved across to the next mile road. So now we're looking across the field at this thing, and so it's exactly a mile away, it's on the road. And all of a sudden I saw another white one coming down the road, and you can tell cars, because cars will have they'll cast beams of light. The difference between this and cars is that you look at a car light, you can see the beams actually coming off. It's projecting light. Whereas this thing was a dead light. It would be completely dead. You could tell whether it was a car or whether it was this object. So I could see this thing was coming down, and it definitely did not appear to be a car. And I said, man, there's another one coming down, and it's coming right at the other one. They're going to collide. So again, this is 1976. We're using a tripod, 35 millimeter film. You don't use a tripod, you're not going to get anything, because it's just going to be, you can't hold the camera still in the dark. So I'm actually trying to set up this tripod, because I can see these two things are going to collide. And when they collided, it was like a giant like a bomb exploding, but with no sound. It was the weirdest thing. It just like went to maybe 20 times its size and then slowly went back down. I managed to get a picture of it as it was almost down to normal. So I got that. Then I said, okay, let's walk across the field. Remember, the field was kind of muddy. So these young kids and I went trooping across this this farm field. Nothing had been planted here yet. It was spring, still wet, or summer, but it was, I remember it was wet in the field. And we were heading towards this object that was sort of like halfway down the mile road in the south. And when we finally got to the light, because it was the same idea of walk to it instead of drive the car, try to sneak up on it, I figured we could do it again. When we got there, it appeared like it was on the next mile road. It had just moved to the next mile road, that we'd never gotten any closer. It was the same distance. And while I was standing there, it was very weird because it was just, it sounded like you were inside a beehive. It was very, very loud, buzzing noise. And I looked at the telephone lines and I figured, oh, why these lines? I figured it was the lines that were buzzing. So I put my ear against the telephone pole. It was really, really loud, the telephone pole. And it was actually the end of the line because this was like an abandoned road. So there was really nothing beyond the telephone poles. And it went down maybe another half mile and then they ended. And so then we discovered, which is we'd seen before, was we looked down the telephone poles. Couldn't see anything. Then I stepped out and looked over the line. And it was right there. It was, I think, three telephone poles. So it was sitting on top of the line. But if you were under the line, you couldn't see it. And we noticed this with, it had like a directional thing. We saw this in the middle of the road as well. If you stood in the middle of the road, you could see this object on the road. But if you actually moved to the side of the road, maybe 3 feet over, you couldn't see it anymore. It was like it was only could be seen from the middle of the road. And that was this sort of thing where I looked out and this thing was sitting right above the telephone lines, maybe three telephone poles away. And I don't remember really what happened after that in terms of, we didn't try to film it or anything, but that was one of the other times I got close. The other time that I got close was the one with the triangle. That would have been 1976 as well. I've got these kids, different kids. There's all these kids lived on the street, so some of them times some would come, some wouldn't come. And we go out there, and we found another road, another mile road that had these things on them. And I said to the kids, watch, because we were flashing lights at them. And I said to them, I took the one kid out and I said, watch this. And I flashed the light at it. It would flash back this three times. If you flash three times, it would flash back three times. And side to side, and it would fly back and forth like a leaf across the road. And I don't believe there was even a road at this point. The road had sort of ended. It was sort of a dirt road then. It was, didn't have any gravel on it. And the kid was very fascinated. I'd take the light up and down, and the thing would go up and down. I said, okay, bring your brother out here. Put him in the car, and got his brother from the back seat. There was three kids in the back. Kenny McKenzie was in the front seat, and I was driving. Took the second brother, one of the brothers, out from the back seat, and I flashed three times at this thing. So this time, instead of it flashing back, it may have flashed back, but I just remember it started to make this beeping, whistling noise. And it was at that point this instantaneous fear broke out. It was like, oh my God, what have I done? You know, there's nothing in this thing. It's got to be a little tiny monitor. Now I've got it angry, and now the big one's going to come. And I looked up as I said that, and there was this huge arc welding light on the American border. And the panic was unbelievable. So I said to the kid, I said, come on, let's get back in the car. And I go, oh no, we're not coming home. None of these kids, you know, what am I doing? Got these kids in the car. I'm responsible for this. And this isn't going to end well. And I remember looking out the side of my window. The one kid said that it shot a blue beam down on top of these objects as it went by. It kept going east, then made the turn. Came, I could see it sort of moving, and I'm going, don't turn, don't turn. And it started to turn, started to go north, and then it made the turn west towards us down the road. And it was coming straight down the road at us. And it was fairly low, it seemed to be fairly low. And I didn't know what to do. The panic was unbelievable. As it came in close, I said to the kids in the back, I said, give me my binoculars. And I had a good set of 7x35 binoculars, very clear. I remember holding the binoculars against the inside of the glass of the car because my hands were shaking so bad. And I looked up at this thing, and it was the entire field of vision. It was right above the car. Moved and it was sitting there above the car. And then, as I've described so many times, it was like you broke a film and put it back together again. It was a jerk in the film. And as soon as that jerk happened, the fear instantly went away. The fear was completely gone. And this thing started to float very slowly into the northeast towards a microwave tower at Brunk Hill, Manitoba. Royal Canadian Mounted Police came up minutes later. I pointed out to him as he asked what's going on. See that object? Yeah, he saw the object clear as day, this triangle of two red lights in the front and a green light in the back with the flat edge coming towards us. Not with the point, but the flat edge, almost like flying backwards. And then I showed him these lights on the road, which weren't there when we first got there. I lifted the light up. These lights started to appear. He immediately realized what was going on and said, I'll see you guys, got in his car, and took off as fast as he could with these kids chasing him down the road with their flashlight trying to get his license plate number, which they did get. So that was one. That was the one where people asked if you ever been abducted. I said, well, if I had been abducted, that was the time it happened. It was very weird. With this fear, where it came on instantly and it disappeared instantly. And that object was either very, very big or very, very low above the car. Years later, I've only interviewed one of the kids about that incident. He went on to become an aeronautical engineer, I believe, in Europe. And he said, you remember that one with the gunmetal gray? I said, gunmetal? I don't remember the metal. And he recalled metal. He recalled seeing metal. I don't remember metal. I just remember these huge, huge lights in the corner of this triangle that might have been 5 or 10 feet across. I mean, that's what I was in my impression. And even thought at one point there may have been three objects that just were flying in formation. But I would guess that it was three lights on this big, huge object that came and sat right above the car. So those are my experiences with UFOs. I had no hitchhiker events. After that, didn't follow me home. I had a lot of sightings in 75, 76. We used to chase this thing. But nothing that would really, except for the one time we were chasing it. That's when we learned that the world was round. Because every 8 miles, I think it is, they moved the mile road 50 feet in one direction because the world is round. And you have to keep moving the road because of the curvature of the earth. I remember the one night we were chasing it, we were actually catching up. It goes so slow that you can actually catch up on it. So we were actually gaining on this thing, getting closer and closer and closer to it as it was sort of sauntering along at 100 feet or 150 feet or whatever it was. And suddenly the car was up in the air, and I go, oh, wow, we're getting abducted. And so I guess my first thought is, wow. And what had happened is they moved the mile road and we drew in right off the end of the mile road because we weren't using lights. We were driving without lights down these roads. Luckily, there was a pile of snow in the field, so there was no damage to the car, and we were able to drive out of the field and continue on. I did have a couple other sightings, which were nothing. Well, I can't say nothing major. I had one with DESTA. This would be whenever it was 2000. It was when we went to Shasta, so that would be the year of the eclipse, 2019. We go to the Oregon Ranch, Cisetti Ranch. We have a sighting there of this object that's flashing. And at first I thought it was a plane, but no, it was definitely something very, very weird. It had this flashing thing going on. Very low, no other lights except for this couple that flashed about 3 or 4 times. And so then we were going towards Vancouver. We're coming up through British Columbia and then going to go west across Canada back to Winnipeg. And This object happened during the day. Destiny was driving. She saw it. I didn't see it. And she was watching it. And it was on the right-hand side of the road, so I'm in the passenger seat, so it's on my side of the car. And we're driving around, and she said, "Look at that, look at that." And I looked up as it was going over top of the car, and it was pretty weird. I'm not sure how far up, maybe 500 feet, maybe not even that. And I immediately looked at her, and she said, "Did you see it?" I said, "What did you see?" She said, "Light bulbs." I said, "What kind of light bulbs?" And she said, "Clear light bulbs." And I said, "That's what I saw too." What it looked like, that someone had taken, say, six in a triangle. So six clear light bulbs minus the part you screw in, round light bulbs, and it glued them together in a triangle. And these light bulbs were flying in this triangle. That's exactly what it looked like. It looked like six light bulbs or say nine light bulbs that were glued together in a triangle and were flying south and we were going north. So we moved very, very fast. I only saw it for maybe a split second. Desta was watching it as it came in. But when she actually confirmed clear light bulbs, I said, "That's exactly what I saw." So we saw that one. Then I had one after a UFO meeting, which was kind of weird, but it was yellow. It was sort of an object. It wasn't a light. It was more of an object. It was in sort of close. A number of people saw it, but it was unidentified. You really couldn't tell. It was moving towards the south. Then I had one that I've only remembered recently, and that was I had one. I went to work on a book with Angela Joyner. She was living in Texas, and I went there after I retired. And Randall had come home and was calling us out of the house. He said, there's something out here. We came racing out. It was daylight. And unfortunately, Randall and Angela are now passed away. So I'd like to be able to remember what it was. It was something very unusual. I remember looking at it and going, wow. Didn't look like a plane. Didn't look like a UFO. Didn't look like it was whatever it was some strange sort of shape. And it was moving north towards Dallas. And we watched it. It was in sight for maybe 30 seconds. Randall had seen it, must have seen it closer because it was sort of moving partly in the distance when we finally came out. So we all stood there and watched this thing. And then the jet fighter came right in behind it. It was out of sight already, I think. Then the jet fighter came. Then there was another jet fighter came from the west. Yeah, from the west. In that sort of direction that it had gone. So it was the two jet fighters. So that was kind of strange. And unfortunately, unless I get regressed, I can't remember exactly what the thing looked like. But it was a daylight sighting. And it wasn't just a dot. It was an actual object, but it was a shape that I don't really recall. Now, when it comes to paranormal, as I said, I really haven't had that many paranormal experiences. I did have some synchronicities, which happened. Most of them happened with Sinead Wellahan. We met in 2020 online. She'd met me before at a conference in Toronto, but we sort of got together online in January of 2020, and we had some wild synchronicities for a month. We did a video, and hopefully we got all this. You can go back, and I may try to repost the video. Maybe I'll attach it to this audio. We did a video where we talked about the synchronicities. We had three in a period of about 6 hours. And these were synchronicities that, the way I described them is, you'll never believe this. These type of synchronicities, like, you never believe this could possibly happen. Two of them I can remember here, and if I can find the audio of that discussion we had, I'll attach it. This shows you how weird these synchronicities are. we had been dealing with a producer in Toronto by the name of Teza Lawrence. And Teza had used the expression at one point, real funny expression, said, talking about people feeling oppressed and their ego gets control and stuff. It's like, okay, time to get off the cross. We need the wood. So we were making this joke, and then so it was the one morning Sinead was crying about something, or she was complaining about something, or I can't remember what it was. And that's when I said to her, okay, time to get off the cross. We need the wood. And within, again, well, that was one correct quote, but within an hour, I got an email from somebody sending me a video, connection to a video of Monty Python's circus. Always put the best, always look at the bright side of life with all the guys on the cross. And when I saw that, I went like, how is that even possible? I mean, it's just so bizarre where, you know, suddenly I get this video, this funny video from Monty Python of these guys, you know, on the cross. That was the one. And the same morning, the other one that happened was I guess I was talking to Sinead about important books to read. And the ones that I said that she should read is two books by Dr. Robert Lanza. Now, Robert Lanza, I learned about him through Chris Waters, who is Barbara Streisand's stepson, who's an experiencer who had the encounter, and then he said to the intelligence that he was dealing with, okay, so if you're an alien or whatever you are, put something in my head I don't already know. And he said, in his own voice, he heard in his head, biocentrics. And he said, what's that? So he goes and he looks it up on the internet, and it's this concept by Dr. Robert Lanza that biology is the core of the universe. It's almost like the holographic universe theory based upon biology. There's no time and space, the whole stuff that we're all sort of getting into now about what is ultimate reality. So Lanza had written Biocentrics and Beyond Biocentrics. And I was telling Sinead that she had to read these books. Well, within an hour, I got an email from Walter Rooker, who sometimes will be on doing interviews with me on physical mediumship, Bashar. He's got a lot of material. He's an expert on a lot of subjects. And he sent me an email at the same time and said, you know, I saw your lecture at Contact in the Desert. And you were talking about Robert Lanza. Here's PDF copies of his book. It's happened like within minutes. And when you have that, and there was a third one, which I don't really recall, but these all happened within the same morning and afternoon. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it was finished. Then I had the two the most bizarre one I'll do last. So these two appear in a book that eventually, hopefully, I'll put out. It's on Apports and Manifestations, which is where things will manifest into the physical world from spirits or aliens or psychics. This stuff will pop in. This was happening with Uri Geller at the SRI, where stuff was dropping in the labs and stuff like that. So this has been around. People know this whole thing, especially the idea of manifestations, where at seances, a lot of physical mediums are able to make, glass, crystal type stuff appear, coins appear. There's a lot of these stories about these kind of things sort of falling out of the ceiling and stuff like that. And the one that we had, and I'm not sure where these two events happened the same year, but there's two events that happened at Paula Harris's conference. One had to do with the feathers that will be in this book, and there was... escapes me what the exact number was, maybe 9 witnesses and 13 events that had to do with white feathers. And it started with Paula. I came to the conference, that's when I got into apportations. I started looking at apports and manifestation, and I was looking at it before they came. I was at the conference a couple days before, and I was studying this, and then I got to the conference, then they said, Tony from London wants to talk to you. And he has these photographs he wants you to see. And I said, well, I'm not really into photographs or UFOs and stuff like that. and said, no, he came all the way from London, and he said he has to see you. And this is a synchronistic story where he suddenly decides that he's got to go. He's never left the country. And he's very sick. He's got Crohn's disease. And he's had a number of operations. And suddenly decides he has to go to this conference. And his wife says, are you crazy? You got kids? You can't leave the country. So Tony said, he went out into the backyard and he says, well, come on, you know, if you want me to go to this conference, give me a sign that I should go. And this white feather falls in front of him. So he goes out the next day and a second white feather falls in front of him. And then a third, or is it the wife had the third, now the story's escaping me. He has these feathers and then he tells his wife, well, he had these signs and that he has to go, that he's sure he has to go. And he doesn't actually tell his wife he's actually already bought the tickets to the conference. And so what happens is, I think he has three feathers. And then she decides, she said, no, it's crazy, you're insane, you shouldn't go. And she works in London, takes the train into London, 30-minute train ride, I think it is. And so she is walking to the train and says, okay, if it's Tony should go, give me a sign that... that he should go. And suddenly there's this white feather. Oh no, she gets to London, that's what it is. She gets to London and she said, okay, if he should go, then give me a sign and show me a feather on the London Bridge. Because there's never feathers on the London Bridge. So she's walking across the London Bridge and there in front of her falls a feather in front of her. Now she's kind of freaking out because now she's having her own experience. So I think it's the same day she goes back on the train and she says, okay, if this is for real, then I want to see not just one feather. I want to see a bunch of feathers. I want to see all sorts of feathers. She comes to the train station where she gets off. The door opens and there's a bush there and it's completely filled with feathers, all these feathers sticking out of this bush. Now she's thoroughly convinced that she should let him go. She tells him this story after the kids go to bed. He comes to the Laughlin conference, and he's the guy who wants to talk to me. He tells me the story about the feathers. Then people at the conference start having these feather experiences. There was a group from London who were heading home, had this feather fall in front of them. And as the feather was falling, one of the people looked up, and there was this UFO in the sky, where the feather just crossed that field of vision. And there was a friend of mine, Mark, out of California, who's up on the 15th floor. His white feather goes by. The windows slowly moving around the window and then moving back again. That happened on Saturday night. And then on the morning when we were going home, down comes Paula Harris with a shirt with a big giant feather on it. And she said she'd bought it in Italy a number of years before and had brought it to the conference. So how would she know that there's going to be this feather thing? And then Dest and I went to Tucson, Arizona, thought this was all over. And we were at a church there and at the gift shop. And I saw these cards with these feathers on them. And I started photographing these cards with the feathers. I thought, this is really weird. And as I put the second card down, there's Desta standing there holding a white feather. And she had been standing outside waiting for me, and this white feather had fallen down right onto her foot. Those kind of synchronicities, when you see those, link up one after another over a couple of days. Pretty amazing, but it's not the most amazing. The most amazing paranormal event of my life, and this is not going to make much sense to a lot of people, because unless you do PowerPoint presentations, you will not realize how significant this was. I have done literally hundreds of PowerPoint presentations. I was one of the first people on the UFO circuit ever to use PowerPoint. I had learned to do it. I had learned to put videos and audios into my PowerPoint presentation. I knew how to link all this stuff. I knew how to make it run so that I'd have a blank. I'd have a slide without the audio, and then the very next slide was the same slide with the audio in the background. I knew exactly how to do this. I'd done it for probably 15 years. I had been doing PowerPoint. So I'm at the Paula Harris's Starworks conference. I'm working on the support thing. The feather thing is happening. There's all these weird things that I had started to work on at ports. And what happens at a conference for people who aren't familiar with speaking at conferences, they basically want your presentation what's called a 16:9 format. So it used to be 3x4, which is a regular screen. But now everybody's doing high definition screens, so they want it 16:9 because it's a wide screen. So I was told, get your PowerPoint presentation at 16:9. I know I had it 16:9. And then when you go to the conference, you have to test your thing. You want to test it. And usually I like to use my own computer because it's on your computer and you don't have to worry about moving it onto somebody else's computer. But usually the conference wants it on their computer. They want all the PowerPoint presentations on the one computer. So what you do, for people who haven't done PowerPoint, is you take the PowerPoint presentation when you're finished. And I had been working on this PowerPoint presentation right up till it was late. It was 7 o'clock at night. I was lecturing the next morning. People were a little upset that I hadn't done my test yet. And I remember Paula was taking a bunch of people to an Italian restaurant at 8 o'clock. And I was busy trying to test this thing about 7:15. I was the last person, I think, to test. So what you do is you take your PowerPoint presentation and then you go save as a file. Then you, where's the file? And then you put it in on a thumb drive. So you choose the thumb drive, you move it onto the thumb drive, and then it says very key at the end. It gives you an error message and says, do you want to link your slides? Now what this is when you're doing audio, you put an audio on the slide. But you have to, what's called, link it. You have to get the PowerPoint presentation will recreate that audio onto the thumb drive. If you don't link it, then when you go in your presentation and you present, the slide will be there, but there's no audio because the audio is back on your computer. So it has to make a second copy and link it and put it into the PowerPoint presentation on the thumb drive. So that's what I do. I get the thumb drive. I'm all ready to go. I go racing down. The guy's waiting, and I'm the last one to test. Stick it into his computer, and he downloads it onto the computer. Everything goes fine. And then he says, have you got any audio? That's usually the first question. Have you got any audio or video? So what you want to do is you want to test your audio to make sure your audio is going to come across the speakers that they're using in the conference room, and you want to make sure that your video plays on the screen on their system. Now, Paula has a very complex arrangement behind. They have all these, all this equipment in behind the curtain, computers and people working there. There's probably 3 or 4 people working all the audiovisual stuff. Loaded on there, opens up, says, you got any audio? Yeah, I said, there's 2 slides and it's like, maybe a slide about 12 and slide 18 or something. It's, you know, right at the beginning. So they're right at the beginning. So I'll go click, 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 click. And it's kind of weird. All these slides are doubled up. And I get to the thing and there's no audio. And I said, what the heck's going on? There's the audio. The audio's missing. And I said, well, keep going. And it was click, 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 click. And there was no audio. So that was the first problem. And so you think, well, I didn't link the slides, but I couldn't even find the slides. I knew what the slides were because we have a double slide with each. One has no audio on it, which tells you the slides coming up, and then the second one has the audio on it. And I noticed all these slides are doubled up. Now, if you know how to do PowerPoint, this is impossible. Unless you absolutely spend time to double up slides, you can't double up slides. There's double slides, and I would say there was maybe 150 slides in the presentation. I would say there was at least 40 slides that were double. And he said, well, that's weird. I didn't do that. He said, well, maybe you made a mistake. I know what it is. It's like, no, you made a mistake. And it's like, no, I know how to do PowerPoint. Let me tell you, I know this. I did not do this. And he's looking at me with this, you know, yeah, okay, whatever you, yeah. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I was getting upset. And then what was happening is I said, you have this 3x4 and this 16:9 setup. So what happens is if you build it all in 16:9, it's all going to be the same. But if you have one slide and you move it from 16:9 to 3x4, it's going to sort of stretch the slide. So some of these slides were stretched, but they were stretched very weird. They were all blurry and stretched. And I'm going, what is going on? And there's all these double slides. There was a couple of triple slides. There was all these slides that were sort of out of the wrong format. And yet there were slides that were all correct. And the audio slides were missing. And then he kept going. And then suddenly there was the audio. But the audio was on a different slide. It was the audio, and I'm going, that's impossible. And he's looking at me like, you don't know what you're doing. I'm going, I know what I'm doing. I know how to link a slide. There's no way I would put the audio on the wrong damn slide. The presentation was actually sitting on my desk in the hotel room. And I was really frustrated. And I'm thinking, what is going on? How could this possibly happen? So then he was sort of, you know, frustrated. I was frustrated. I said, okay, I'm going back. I'm going to load it again. I go back to the room. I'll load it again. I'll be right back. So then I go running to go out of the room, and Paula says, you come into the restaurant? You come to the Italian restaurant? I said, bah, I got trouble with my thing. My whole slide presentation is all messed up. She says, well, you know what's happening, don't you? And I said, no, that's not what's happening. And I was insistent. There's no way weird stuff was happening. And so I go back to the room, and the computer's actually open. It's on the desk, and the screen is on. And I've got the little Hollywood Squares version where you can see all the slides. You can see maybe 24 slides at a time. And I'm looking, and it's completely normal. There's no double slides. There's no weird slides. And one of the slides, which is one of Tony's slides, which makes me think it may have been the year after Tony, is one of the slides he gave me. Yeah, maybe it was the same year. Anyway, one of the slides he'd given me was a slide of black helicopters. Just a lot of low-flying helicopters. And the question is, what are these helicopters? Because they're very low. You'd be at the hospital in London, and this thing's like 50 feet above the hospital. Like, there's no way you can have I think it was a police helicopter hovering above the emergency room door at the hospital. That was kind of weird. But the thing was that his photographs, and what I've noticed with helicopter, low-flying helicopter photographs in the UFO field, is that a lot of them have UFOs in them. So you have this low-flying helicopter, and he had two of them that had these UFOs in. So one of the slides in the presentation was one of these helicopter slides with the UFO on it, but it flipped sideways. It was actually going the other way. And so I looked, and that slide's the right way. I looked, there's the audio slides. The audio slides are exactly where they are, and I'm going, okay, let's do it again. So what I do is I take everything off the disk or the thumb drive, make sure it's completely clean, so we're not going to have any, you know, redoing of whatever it is. Look at the presentation on the desk, completely normal. Okay, same thing. File, save as, you know, go through the whole process, link the slides or whatever. And then I said, well, I'm not coming back again. So if this goes bad again, so what I'll do is, the audio always makes you look really bad, and video and audio don't work in your presentation. It maybe makes you look like an idiot. So I said, okay, I'll make a second version of the presentation without the audio slides. I don't need the audio slides. I'll take the audio off. I'll just leave the slide itself, and I can wing it. I know what the slide says. I don't have to play the audio. So I make a version with the audio and a version without the audio. Go running back up, and he said, oh, we had it going. I said, oh, great, you had it going. In behind. He said, yeah, come behind. And they go in behind. Open it up. It's the same thing. And then now he looks like an idiot. It's like, you know, he told me he had this thing going, and no, it's the same thing. All these double slides and slides flipped sideways and stretched and all this kind of stuff. And just like really, really weird. Like at least every third slide was totally messed up in this presentation. So we go back on set. I take the video, the PowerPoint that I just moved again off the computer, put it on there, same thing. Nothing had changed. Doubles, triples, stretch slides, sideways, no audio. The actual audio slides are gone. Now I'm really frustrated. And he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, just take off all the double slides. Or he asked me, so you want me to take off the double? Well, of course I want you to take off the double slides. Just take off the double slides. Just take them off. I don't care. Don't worry about it. Just click it. Delete everything that's double or triple, and I'll wing it during the presentation. I'll figure out what it is. And the next day, I did the presentation. There was a couple of errors the next day, things that happened. But that, to me, was the most paranormal thing I'd ever seen, because I've done a lot of PowerPoint, And I can tell you, of all the things that happened on that PowerPoint, none of them were possible. Absolutely not possible. It was what I call the theory of wow. It was like, watch what we can do. It was the most bizarre thing. And that will be in the book on applications and manifestations. I have photographs of these different slides that were doubled up and tripled up and blurred and stretched and just really, really weird, because absolutely not. I've done a couple hundred. I've never had one of those things happen at any point in any presentation. And here we had every third slide, some 50, more than 50 slides were completely damaged and turned around and doubled up and stuff like that. It was the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen, but it was a great sort of demonstration of, if there is a phenomenon behind this, how powerful this phenomenon is and what it can do. Because I've never seen anybody describe this before, and I had it happening in spades. So that's my paranormal events. Other than that, I really haven't had many paranormal events. I'm unlike other people. I've never had lucid dream. People always say, oh, I can do out-of-body experience. I've tried all these things for years and years and years. And then I become a skeptic like everybody else. The things that I've seen, like UFOs, I have no doubt. But the things that I haven't done, I still reserve this thing where, well, you never know. I mean, back of your mind, you're going, are these people actually telling the truth? I've never been able to do it. And these are the weird things that have happened in my life. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. Okay, stop the press. One of the most bizarre stories I ever had, I've forgotten to tell. That's the story of Nellie, the black lab that belonged to Chris Bledsoe. Here's the short version. I've told it a number of times. You've probably heard the story. I'm going from the citizens' hearing 2013. I'm heading to Florida to give a lecture for Paula Harris. I'm going past Chris Bledsoe's place. He's a famous experiencer in North Carolina, 2007. Five witnesses. They have 13 UFOs. They have the abduction experience, beings in the forest, the whole bit. Anyway, I go there and to see Chris. He's right on the highway going down to Florida. I stop. He takes me around, shows me all the different places where all these events took place. There's a burning tree in the backyard. And I won't go into that story, but I'm taking photographs of this famous burning tree. And we are at his house. I'm heading for Florida the next day. So next day, his wife and the kids are out doing stuff. It's just Chris and I in the living room with his three dogs. Chris puts the dogs outside. And we're sitting there playing on Facebook, and I'm getting ready to go. And all of a sudden, Chris says, what are you guys doing back in the room? And these three dogs, there's a big black lab, a medium-sized dog, and a little chihuahua, are standing in the middle of the room looking at us. And he said, I put you outside. How'd you get back in the house? So we go over to the front, and the front door is wide open, and he puts the dogs back out, closes the door. A couple minutes later, I leave for Florida. I head to Florida, and when I get to Florida, there's a email, and Chris says, you know, when you left, it happened twice more. After you left, I was in the house, and suddenly the dogs were back in the house again. The front door was wide open. I put the dogs back out, went to the bathroom, came out of the bathroom, and the dogs were back in the house, front door was wide open. And, of course, I thought, well, so what? You left the door open. It was like, you know, I didn't really take it that significant. That's what I thought. So when I go back, I'm heading back to Washington because I got to drop off the U-Drive car. And I stop at Chris's place again. This happens within a couple of minutes after I stop heading back north. We're standing there. I go take a few more pictures of the burning tree. We're standing. There's a patio, concrete patio at the back of the house. Nellie, the black lab, is right behind us on the lawn. She's chewing on a gourd. And he looks at her, what are you chewing that thing for? And then you chewed it already. And so she kept chewing. She's lying there very quietly and chewing on this gourd. And then he says to me, he says, oh, you want to go inside? I said, yeah, okay. So we go to go inside, and Chris is on the right, I'm on the left, and Nellie comes on my left-hand side. And people all know how this works. The dog wants to get in the house before you, so the dog figures, okay, let's go, and he goes racing by me. And as we're at the back door, and the door's open, and then I hear Chris yell out, Nellie, Nellie, what happened to you? And I look at Nellie, and there's blood shooting out the side of her neck, up on the walls, on the floor. It looked like a, as Chris described, like a hose, like an artery had been hit. And so as her heart is pumping, this blood is shooting out all over the place. And so when the dog was being let out, or let into the room, the front door wide open, I thought, yeah, it's nothing. It's just like leaving the door open. As soon as I saw this, I said, well, this is weird. And I had the camera, luckily, on the front in the car. I hadn't even taken stuff out of the car yet. I run to the car, to the rental car. The camera's right there. I grab the camera, I come back, and I start filming this whole thing. I start taking photographs. By now, he's got Nellie on the ground, pulled her down the stairs onto this concrete patio. She's lying there very quietly, not doing anything. Chris has got a rag, and he's got the rag on Nellie's neck. And Chris Jr. comes out with this semi-automatic rifle, and I walk around with him. He's all upset. He's going to shoot the raccoon. And I said, there's no raccoon. And I'm going to shoot the dog. I said, there's no dog. She was standing right behind us. We would have heard if something had bit her. We couldn't figure out. We knew exactly where the blood had started. It started on the edge of the patio. But we couldn't see what had cut her or anything like that. And the girlfriend is on her knees, and she's cleaning up the blood all over the walls and the floor and stuff like that. And I'm talking to Chris about whether we're going to, you know, stick her to the vet. Maybe she'll be dead by the time she gets to the vet because she's losing blood. And Chris cuts off the collar, and Nellie's just quietly lying there. And then he lifts up the rag, which is completely filled with blood. And Nellie gets up, wags her tail, and goes racing off. And I go chasing after her. She runs around the side of the house and into the front. She barks at the front door one time. And it goes racing off in the next door neighbor's yard as if she's chasing something. And Chris and I had a discussion, and my interpretation was that they wanted this in a film. Warner Brothers at that time wanted a movie. They were going to spend $80 million on a movie telling this very bizarre story of paranormal phenomena happening around Chris after the first UFO sighting and the family and stuff like that. And they wanted this in the movie. Chris thought it was the Shadow People. And I said, no, I think it's just they want this in the movie. This is a bizarre thing. They want just this wild story. And a couple of weeks later, I got confirmation that Chris contacted me and said, you still got those photographs you were taking of Nellie with the blood thing? And I said, yeah. He said, could we get copies? Warner Brothers would like to see them. And so if anybody ever does a Chris Bledsoe version of this story, you will see this very bizarre story with Nellie with the blood. And the other weird last thing on this thing with the blood was, as I said, she'd come on my left side. And when it was all said and done, I looked at my pants. And how long does it take a dog to run by you to go in the house? Like a quarter of a second? It looked like the dog had been standing there for about 30 seconds. It was blood up and down the side of my pants. And it was sort of like, you didn't think it was interesting. You didn't think it was amazing watching us let the dogs in the front door. Watch this. And that was clear as day to me that I was in the center of this thing. The blood was all over me, all over my pants. And then what happened was I said, well, I've got these famous pants now. I'm never going to wash these pants because I've got the blood all over them. And then a month later, I thought, nah, I'll wash the pants. I washed the pants, and there was absolutely no trace whatsoever. After the blood had been in there for a month, absolutely no trace whatsoever. I still got the pants, but you would never know that there was any blood. But it was a very, very bizarre incident, which confirms my idea that all of what they're doing is just the theory of wow. They're doing these very weird, strange things because they want you to go wow and realize you are not alone. There's something very weird going on. The world is not the way you think it is. So once again, thanks for listening, and we'll do it again soon.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.